Thursday, but I'd rather go ahead and keep this conversation focused, and so that when we have to consider all three, that as a policy, we have all the best information to us at what we might allow out under that heading of income tax. You know,
I think that's an excellent idea to put that in example form, and I don't believe it's any problem for Mr. Williams to work that up, and Mr. Persley will be here on Tuesday to help present that.
Thank you, Representative Wilson.
Unless there's further questions on the tax base, I think I will move on to the rate question, which is the next one here. One of the big questions in rate is, do you want a graduated rate or do you want a flat tax? Now, what the governor's proposal is, it takes a flat tax on federal tax liability, and that picks up the graduated rates that are within the federal system. Graduated tax rates are very common. Most states that have income taxes have graduated rates. Certainly we're all familiar with the federal system. And the way it works, I think as Representative Crawford pointed out, is that for everybody, your initial income, your first, what is it, $7,000, it would not be subject to tax, and then your next dollars earned would be subject to the lowest tax bracket, which used to be 15%, and it's going down now. And then your next, again, incremental graduations, so that there's no penalty for moving into the next bracket. And again, Representative James has argued very eloquently what she sees as the advantage of a flat tax. And if there's one thing I've learned, it's never to get into a debate with Representative James. But I would want to just put on the record, and I think Representative Crawford has expressed it, that the advantage of the graduated rates is that those who are in the higher brackets are earning more. They're able to take more advantage of the advantages of civilized society in which we are all able to live and work. And they are left with more disposable income even after the effects of the graduated rates, which now with the federal rates as they are, and we're just piggybacking on the federal rates, the graduations are not nearly what they used to be, either with the federal rates or with the old Alaska law that we repealed in
1990. Neil, just on that point, one of the things we heard discussed earlier today was the complexity of the federal law changing the complexity of the state law, and how we would match that. And do you see that you're kind of coming in at a flat tax rate of that graduated tax, if I understand how you've written this? So do you sidestep that discussion?
Representative Coghill, yes, we do. We're assuming that the policy behind the federal tax changes in general we adopt here. And so that, yes, in the future, for example, there is going to be an additional child tax credit as part of the most recent act, and we think that's probably a good policy, and we pick it up. If there's policy changes that the future legislatures don't want, then they can certainly amend.
Right. Representative Fate had a question as well.
Yeah, could you provide us with some data, in particular in Alaska, on the ratio of discretionary income to gross income, please?
Ratio of discretionary income to gross income. Could you define what discretionary income?
Well, you were relating how, on the basis of the graduated tax, you said that, as Representative Crawford had intimated, that those people with a low income had less discretionary income. And I just would like, I'd like to see some data on that.
Okay. I'll attempt to work that up. That's a broad policy. It's more of a common sense notion that we have there.
Through the chair,
Representative Faith.
You know, regardless whether it's common sense or not, I know people with high incomes that have very, very little discretionary income, and people with low incomes that have a lot of discretionary income. I would like to see some data on it. That's all I'm requesting.
Well, Representative Faith, we'll try to do that. I've never seen statistics published on discretionary income, but I can have my staff.
Okay, then you don't really know, but I would like to see the data that you have on that.
Okay. Representative Hayes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This will be really quick. I appreciate the work that you all have done on this issue too. I'm just wondering, for property owners, which ultimately seems to be the rub, property owners who pay property taxes for education in their communities, have you all thought about including some type of credit, as in Representative Moses' bill, and how much money would you actually lose by doing that?
Through the chair, Representative Hayes, we have discussed that that question in the past, and that is one advantage, again, of picking up federal tax liability, and that there is a deduction for state taxes paid when you compute your federal tax liability. So that's already included in there. The reason that we did not go with a property tax credit, such as Representative Moses has in his bill, a couple of reasons. One is that there's some double counting when you have a credit on top of taxes that have already been deducted. Another problem that we see with it is that I know when I was a renter, when the local property taxes here in Juneau went up, my rent bill went up. So that really, if you're a renter, you are paying what I might call an imputed property tax, and yet that person isn't going to get to take advantage of the credit or even the deduction. So in some ways, just we believe having a one-for-one property tax credit is unfair to that portion of the property of the population that isn't a homeowner. The final reason that we did not go with a property tax credit is that the Department of Law questioned the constitutionality of allowing a property tax credit only for property tax paid in the state. There's a line of cases that is very clear in taxation that you cannot discriminate against non-residents, and the federal courts are very vigilant about enforcing discrimination problems that they see in state taxes. Now, I don't know that the Department of Law ever reached a conclusion on that analysis. The question was raised. It was a significant enough question that we chose not to go there in our analysis. Now, the final part of your question was how much would the property tax credit cost the state. We have that number in the fiscal note for HB 10. But I'm not sure I can point to it immediately as I look there. The revenue raised by HB 10 is on the last page of our analysis. And I'm sorry that I'm not able, I can get back to you on that. I'll have our economist.
And maybe that's something that we need to zero in on as we go down to looking at the governor's bill. And I know I was looking for more comparison rather than to get in his, because we're going to give him a bite at the apple on next week. And I want to make sure that what I'm looking at here is how do some of the fundamentals interact here. That's what I'm really looking for, and we only got about 10 more minutes to get really to some of those fundamentals. And so if you could continue on down the list. One of the things that I saw in your bill was a figuring of an adjusted rate based on some of our accounts that was different in your bill than any other. And that is a fundamental issue, and it's a trigger mechanism that I've been kind of intrigued with. Figuring a tax base rate used based on where we at with some of our larger accounts like the CBR and the earnings reserve.
Let me address that, because that is right there in this rate question. Yes, what we've done in the governor's bill is we put in a trigger based on the size of the constitutional budget reserve. We, at the Department of Revenue, we recommend that we keep the budget reserve. We not let the budget reserve go below $1.5 billion. We think we need that much money in there to act as a shock absorber, so that if there is a sudden plunge in the price of oil, because even if we have a broad-based tax such as this, and even if we have other tax revenues to balance the budget, we're still, even in the future, going to be dependent upon oil revenue, a very important part of the state's budget. And what we need to have, the Constitutional Budget Reserve sits there and serves as that shock absorber. That's part of the reason that I believe the voters of the state enacted it. So we highly recommend that the CBRF stay at $1.5 billion. That'd be our target goal, to keep it there. But once it starts to climb above that, we believe that we can provide some tax relief to the citizens of the state. And to give ourselves a buffer, we decided to put the trigger in this bill at $2 billion. And then at $2 billion, we can actually, that's a good size shock absorber, we can actually cut the tax rate on the citizens down to 10%. And we still have plenty of buffer there. And then if you were to get above $2.5 billion, we're going to lower the tax all the way down to 5%, which is really just, it's just a hold, it's something to hold the tax in place rather than just do away with it. I mean, we don't want to be in a situation where we're firing employees, laying off employees 1 year when we abolish the tax, and then trying to hire them back and recreate our infrastructure the next year. So we believe that anything above a $2.5 billion surplus, savings account, that the tax rate can go down to 5%.
Representative James has a question on it.
We have a payback requirement on the Constitutional Budget Reserve. How can you sit here and support the Constitutional Budget Reserve as it's currently drafted and not pay it back up to its the payback before you stop taxes?
Through the chair, Representative James. I don't think that the payback provision is an imperative demanding that the state tax its citizens such that we get back to the $6 billion figure that is owed to the CBRF.
That's what I voted for. I mean, were you out there voting for the CBR? What did you think it did? I mean, it does things that I didn't think it did, but that was the one thing that I did think it did, is that this was a fund that was going to be coming from the windfalls, sort of. They were identifying windfalls, which to me weren't really truly windfalls, but what they were is bump-ups in the budget, so we didn't spend too much. Let's crap that off and put this in here, and we can utilize it when we need to, and then when we have the money, we have to pay it back. And so the paying back was a very important part of keeping this pot of money when I voted for it, and I think many people felt the same way.
Through the chair, Representative James, and I can entirely agree with that. What I see, how I see this working is that, let's say we have a big development. Let's say we have the gas line, and as a consequence, we have surplus revenue. That's when the CBRF is going to get paid back, and that's when we're going to see it grow, and I don't want to do anything to inhibit that growth of the CBR all the way back to the full payback. What I don't think it's necessary to do is to tax the citizens at the highest rate that we could stand, in order to replenish the CBR to a number that's far higher than what we need to act as a shock absorber. I think we do need a certain amount, minimum amount in there to act as a shock absorber so that we don't have this sudden fallout in the economy that we saw in 1986 when oil prices plummeted.
And I'm going to let Representative Fate chime in on this. We will have this discussion when this bill comes before us, and I just wanted to lift it up as a matter of principle. Representative Fate?
Well, I did want to make mention so that the viewers of this don't get the wrong impression that a gas pipeline is going to do what an oil pipeline did, and that's going to put the kind of money into the state coffers that can boost and replenish the CBR at even the close rate. We just simply don't get that kind of revenue from gas in comparison as to what we got from oil. And I wouldn't want to beguile the people in the state of Alaska into thinking that's the case. And some people do. Some people are hanging their hat on that gas pipeline, producing the same kind of a revenue that oil did. And that just simply will not happen.
Point very well taken, Representative.
Representative James.
If I just might piggyback on that, the real benefit of having the gas line is to have more high-paying jobs, not the revenue that we get at the state level from the taxes on the oil company. It's the higher-paying jobs and the other kinds of industry it might support.
And when we start taxing people and we start discussing tax policy, we want to make sure that we're not discouraging the very thing we want. And I think as a committee, we want to make sure that as we go down the road of looking at a tax policy to fill a government that is already spending the money that we just don't have, except for in our savings accounts. And when the savings accounts are gone, we're going to have to bear the burden. What can we do with the government? How are we going to produce? And what's the best way to have everybody chime in on this? I'm going to ask a couple of things. One of the policy discussions in this now, we're going to come down to that we'll hear when the governor presents his bill is the difference between the different base rates, how we attach ourselves to the federal government, if you will, whether it's a flat tax, a graduated tax, or a combination of some graduation. There are going to be a variation discussion on exemptions if we get that far in the discussion. And if we don't, then the exemptions become a moot point, except for we'll be talking about COLA and some of the other areas. And I'm really interested in a trust doctrine discussion because I really believe that we've done a lot of work in Alaska to create a pool here and create an environment where we're inviting people, and now we're going to start talking about throttling that door down. What the expected revenues are from this committee is certainly a matter of policy. I think that the Finance Committee is better to deal with that. However, I think we should put some parameters around it, something that we expect, maybe what we might expect the administration to put in place to administer it, and what we expect would be the outcome in general terms. I don't think we can get there specifically, but that'll be on the framework that we put together as a committee. And I really like the idea of the trigger mechanism. I think that that's something that's worthy discussion. I don't know if it'll fit in all the venues. And so those are the kind of the policy things I'll be looking for. And Representative Hudson wants to step forward.
And along those same lines, could I ask the committee to ask the department to consider on all three different approaches the amount of money that would not be flowing to Washington, D.C. in each one of the tax models?
Good point.
Because the governor said in his State of the State that if we impose this tax, $50 million that people of Alaska now pay to the federal government would stay in the state of Alaska. And I think each one of these mechanisms would have some relevance there, and I would appreciate that.
A very good point, and I appreciate that. And can we expect that from you, Neil?
Yes.
And I appreciate that. So that gives kind of the parameters of what I'm looking for as a chairman. I think that my intention is to go into the weekend, next weekend, with the idea of having some language drafted up. I'm going to try and get language for the two tax bills so that when we hear the permanent fund issue, I can give what I think is maybe something that we can start discussing off of. Representative Stevens.
And Mr. Chairman, I have an issue, too, of can we, in fact, is it legal for us to collect property taxes only or give benefit for property taxes paid in the state and not for benefit for property taxes paid out of the state? The issue that you brought up, I think that's a legal question that I'd like to know more about.
All right. Representative James, on that point?
Thank you. On that point, my understanding and my perspective was to only give a credit on the education, and I believe that we could call that a school tax. And they pay it one of two ways. They either pay it on their property tax or they pay it on the income tax, whichever it is. And it could be even identified to be the $100 that I hear all of the state people proposing to do. Could assign $100 of that bottom line as a school tax and then give a refund for those people who in their personal residence pay a property tax that is allocated to schools. And I don't see anything unconstitutional about that.
And
I really appreciate a further discussion from a legal standpoint of that issue.
I agree with that. And one of the things, if we get into that part of the discussion that starts carving out things, I'm really interested in those who pay their own schooling at home, how we might get an exemption for them. So, I mean, you know, I think that's a legitimate part of the discussion. So that's what happens when we go down the discussion of what is and what isn't going to be in this. And appreciate the committee's questions and responses. Thank you for coming before us. We'll look forward to arranging next week, and I'll be in touch with you and as to when you might feel most comfortable presenting before the committee. My aim is Tuesday, but I'm open to changing that. Thanks, Representative Hudson and Representative Moses, for bringing these bills forward. The discussion has begun on income tax. We have not completed it. So thank you very much. We'll call this committee adjourned.